Mr. Sohan's early connection with my explorations in 1853 and 54, his knowledge of the Indian language, his familiarity with the general scope of the country to be traversed, and the influence he had always so beneficially exerted over the Indians, all pointed him out as the proper person to explore the new and dangerous region. His mission was put on foot, but bitterly opposed by the Indians. He kept me advised from time to time of his position and progress, and it was only after being convinced from his several reports that the country was impracticable and his life threatened by the Coeur d'Alenes that I determined to withdraw him and give up all hope of finding a route further south than that by the Coeur d'Alene mission. It was evident from the explorations that had already taken place that the mountains to the south of the Coeur d'Alene River until you reach Salmon River were high, difficult, and probably impracticable for a wagon road, and we were forced from the topography of the country to turn this immense bed of difficult mountains by either a line to the north, which takes us by the Clark's Fork, or by the extreme south, taking us near the head of Snake River, thence tending northward at the Three Buttes at Fort Hall. I was determined, however, to satisfy myself as to the true nature of the country lying between the Clearwater and St. Joseph River, to which I felt favorably disposed from a conversation with General Stevens, who represented the valley of the Palouse at its point of intersection with a line drawn from Coeur d'Alene Lake to Lewiston as being not less than 20 miles broad and extending eastward from this point 70 estimated miles. This caused us both to think that this valley would, at the headwaters of the stream, lend itself as a favorable location for a road to the Bitterroot Valley, but the governor overestimated its true value. I do not think that a route can ever be had in the direction we so much desired to find one. The different parties of Messrs. Sohan, Engel, Howard, and De Lacy started from the Dalles in advance of my main expedition, which left on the 15th of June, and following the usually traveled wagon road, reached Walla Walla by the 28th of June. Tarrying there for temporary repairs and additional outfit, we again started on the 1st of July. A portion of our supplies were forwarded to the mouth of the Palouse by the steamer Colonel Wright, and the remainder transported by wagons to the same point, under general charge of Lieutenant Lyon, 3rd Artillery. The question of wood and water between Walla Walla and the Snake River caused me during this season to locate the route via the mouth of the Duquesne. The spirit of our work, looking simply towards having a low water route or one that summer travel alone demanded, and as along this line the distance between water was much shorter than via the mouth of the Palouse, I was governed by these considerations in its location. The general character of the route is similar to that of the Palouse, a high rolling prairie region, but it is shorter by 2 miles. The country in this section possesses remarkable advantages for grazing, the long red bunch grass giving pasturage to numberless flocks of sheep and corn stock, while the valley bottoms are sufficiently large and fertile to afford not only ample means for the grazers, but could supply the local wants and travel of the country. The creeks found in this length of 48 miles are the Dry Creek, 8 miles from Walla Walla, the Tucci, 21 miles, the Red Creek, 30 miles, and the Tucannon, 40 miles. Already have each and all these valleys become the comfortable homes of the pioneer farmer and grazer, where the hand of industry adding daily to the wealth and prosperity of the country gives a new beauty. By the erection of schoolhouses and churches, those barometers of the intelligence and morality of a people. The waters of the streams flow directly from the snows of the mountains that girt them, and when the wants of the country demand it, an abundance of good mill sites can readily be found. The pure water, free from all alkaline elements, cannot be too highly appreciated by the stock raiser. We reached the Snake River at the mouth of the Duquesne on the 3rd of July, and being delayed in swimming our stock, were not able to proceed until the morning of the 4th, on which date we took up our line of march for the valley of the Palouse at its southern bend. Mr. Sohan, having crossed the Snake River at the Red Wolf's Crossing and returned to the mouth of the Duquesne via the valley of the Smokel Creek, left the section of the Snake River between these two crossings unexplored, so that in order to correctly map the river and the circumjacent country and connect his survey with my own, I was obliged to send Mr. Engel, now returned from Colville, to examine and report upon this line, and a description of its features is contained in his appended report. The general character of the country from Walla Walla to the mouth of the Palouse is an easily rolling prairie, road excellent, camps good with fine water and most abundant grass. The valley bottoms are nearly all densely settled, the land in the bottom being sufficient for farms of considerable size, and the hillsides bowed down in beauty under their loads of most excellent nutritious grasses. We built bridges over the Tucci and Dry Creeks and over a slough 3 miles from Walla Walla, also making slight repairs where needed. With these improvements, the road is a good one, crossing the Snake River without accident, save the drowning of one of my men, who in rafting wood down the stream was caught by its impetuous current and swept out of sight before aid could reach him. We moved from the river on the morning of the 4th of July, and after a severe march of 14 miles reached the Palouse at its junction with Cow Creek. At this point, we found Lieutenant Lyon encamped awaiting our arrival, having moved from the mouth of the Palouse, where our supplies had been debarked. The line from Snake River to this point of the Palouse is over a rolling prairie region, 600 feet above the water, which at the point of crossing is 900 feet and flows through high, broken, basaltic bluff banks. At its intersection with the Tucannon is the site of Fort Taylor, built by Major Wise of Colonel Wright's expedition in 1858. Wherever work was required en route from the Snake to the Palouse, it was done, consisting of slight excavations made by the men while the train was moving. Our different parties having come together on the 5th of July, we moved eastward up the left bank of the Palouse for 6 miles. When fording, we followed its right bank for a mile, to a good camp and halted for the day. The general width of the valley is from half to a mile and a half wide, about 100 feet below the general level of the prairie country around, and bounded on both sides by abrupt bluffs from which crop out at many points basaltic rock, the general formation of this region. Only willows and a few cottonwood fringe its borders. The soil is mostly a black loam and will doubtless produce cereals and vegetables, but the absence of timber is an impediment to its settlement that cannot be easily met. At the headwaters of the stream and its tributaries, limestone is said to be found, and there also in places the soil is fertile and lying as it does under the slopes of the mountains and in close proximity to the Nez Perce mines. It is not at all improbable that the grazier and agriculturalist will find at no distant day tracts of land that will amply repay their reclamation. July 6. Making another ford, we moved along the valley bottom 2.5 miles, when finding more labor required than could be attended to while the train was in motion, we encamped until the morning of the 9th. Our work consisted in grading along an abrupt side hill in loose rock and clay to avoid additional crossings of the Palouse, always difficult, and particularly so when the stream was swollen. At all the fords, the current was swift, running over rocky and pebbly bottoms. It was a question with me whether we should follow the main valley of the Palouse or strike across the high prairie country and go by way of the upper tributaries of the stream. By the former, we pass to the south of the direct line of the Coeur d'Alene and thus go by the way of the Camas Prairies near the headwaters of the Nettlewald, and by the latter to the north of the Pyramid Butte. As the country had not been examined in detail, I deemed it best to avail ourselves of our delay at this point and send Mr. Kolecki forward to explore it and obtain some authentic facts. From the summary of his report appended, I determined to take across the high prairie country, as no doubt was left upon my mind, but that a route to the north of the Pyramid Peak was the better as well as the shorter. Therefore, on the morning of the 9th of July, our work being completed, the train moved forward a distance of 5 miles until we reached and crossed the Mokolisia, the principal tributary from the east, making in this distance 3 fords of the Palouse. On Monday, the 11th of July, resuming the march across the prairie country for 13.4 miles, we reached the Oreteus, the northern fork of the Palouse. In the interval, we had a good road over a level prairie for the most part, and but little work required en route. Springs of water were found in the plains, and copses of the willows at one point sufficient for a small camp. The water of the Ray Tayus was very shallow, being only 18 inches deep, and with its good grazing, willows for fuels and pines within a distance of a mile to the east afforded us a good camp. Distance from Walla Walla, 96 miles. On Tuesday, the 12th of July, continued the march for 16 miles, reaching a camping on the Tuchuseep, a tributary of the Oreteus. The prairie country afforded us a good location. Springs of water were passed on the route. No work of note was necessary. At this point, we entered what might be termed the more difficult section of the basaltic basin, which constitutes the chief characteristic of the Spokane Plains, and hence it became of marked importance to feel our way by examinations in advance that would guarantee to us the best locations. The general face of the country, as well as the map of the line, tended to show that our more direct route was in a direction eastward from our present camp towards the Coeur d'Alene Lake. But to be assured of this, I sent Mr. Sohan forward with a Coeur d'Alene Indian as a guide, whom chance had brought to our camp to make a preliminary examination. On exploring it, he found the ground so cut by deep basaltic canyons and ravines with the bed of the Spectre Lake intervening that we were necessitated to take a more northerly course, and therefore on Wednesday, the 13th of July, we moved forward over a generally easy prairie region interspersed in places with flat basaltic rock and copses of pines for a distance of 9 miles, when we reached the encamped upon the Silsil Sepauvetsen, 121 miles from Walla Walla. The canyon of this creek, at our point of crossing it, was rocky in the extreme, so much so, indeed, that when once into it, it required nice engineering to get out. Half a mile back from the canyon, good grazing fields are found, which, together with the abundance of timber on the borders, will always make it a good camping ground. No other capabilities except grazing are here found. A few acres of good soil of inconsiderable extent occur, but not sufficient to make it an object of especial note. On the 11th or 14th of July, leaving the canyon of the Silsil Sepauvetsen and gaining the higher level prairie country in an elevation of 100 feet, we found a good location for the road requiring light work in places for about 16 and a half miles when we reached the Latu or Nettlewald Creek, which last empties into the Spokane. It is thus seen that on this day's march we crossed the prairie divide that separates the waters that flow into the Snake from those that flow into the Spokane, but by a rise so gradual as to be almost imperceptible, except to the barometer. This interval of 16 miles is a swelling prairie, well grassed and with here and there good tracks for settlement, though the general scope of country is unsuitable for culture. Timber is in sight nearly the whole distance, and though this section will probably never be continuously cultivated, still it offers many inducements for grazers and farmers and enters as an essential element in affording good sites for mail and recruiting stations. By the fine grasses now found and the abundance of forage and supplies, it is capable of producing under the hand of an industrious and diligent culture. We encamped this day on the banks of the Nettlewald and at the same point where General Wright hung Qualshan, the noted Indian chief, and several other Indians, from which fact the stream is known to many as Hangman's Creek. Poor creatures, their doom, although in this instance a just one, is nevertheless pitiable. Had the white man been to them more just, fate had proved less harsh. Our route of this date skirts the lake from which Colonel Steptoe retreated the day of his noted defeat at the hands of the Coeur d'Alene and Spokane Indians. We crossed Nettlewald on the morning of the 15th of July at the point of our encampment, although another crossing is found 1 mile above this point. This stream is subject to very high rises in the spring freshets. Its banks in places are low, in others bordered by high, rocky bluff banks and fringed with groves of open pines. The lower sections are not favorable to settlements, but nearer the mountains its valley widens and offers inducements for small farms here and there, with rich grazing, fine timber in abundance, and watering creeks and springs of the most delicious purity. Leaving the Nedawal, the road for 3 miles passes over gently swelling hills when it reaches a prairie swale or bottom 2 miles in length and 1 in breadth, whence in 7 miles more we reach some pools of water fringed with cottonwoods and pines. After halting to improve the road, we journeyed on through an open prairie basin for 7 miles to some wells, where, being provided with wood in our wagons, we made camp for the night. This portion of the route may be termed a natural wagon road, needing but very slight improvement. It was on this day that we met for the first time a band of the Coeur d'Alene Indians under Pierre, a few miles from our camp. They were well mounted, anxious to learn our mission, our line of direction, and plied us with many questions as to our ultimate ends and objects. A few of these Indians were also met by Mr. Sohan in his exploration toward the head of the Palouse. Discretion and prudence directed that our course towards them should be both frank and honest. I invited them to accompany me to my camp, gave them to eat and to smoke, and afterwards explained to them in detail our mission and object. They left apparently satisfied and with a promise to preserve friendly relations in future. They are wily fellows, and great caution is necessary in all intercourse with them. On the morning of the 16th of July, we resumed our march, moving eastwardly for 9 miles over an easily swelling prairie region timbered for the last 3 miles to a point which I had selected for a depot camp. While our work is progressing in advance, we had left the plains of the Columbia proper and reached the spurs of the Bitterroot Mountains, where our more difficult work commenced. We had chosen for our location a line which, jutting upon the southern edge of the Coeur d'Alene Lake, would follow up for 4 miles of the valley of the St. Joseph's River. When crossing it, would take the most direct line across the divide to the Coeur d'Alene River, thence up the valley of that stream to the Coeur d'Alene Mission. Our first work of difficulty was to make the descent of 700 feet from the tableland to the valley of the St. Joseph's. Several points were examined, but none afforded a natural descent, and I was forced to work one over a long spur making down to the lake at the junction of the St. Joseph's River with the outlet of the Pound Lake. Over this outlet, a bridge of 60 feet was constructed. This piece of excavation was rocky and difficult, but with the bridge was completed in 8 days. I then moved the entire camp up the valley of the St. Joseph's to the point selected for crossing. The St. Joseph's and Coeur d'Alene Rivers are the two arms and feeders of the Coeur d'Alene Lake. They rise in the Bitterroot Mountains between 60 and 70 miles to the eastward, and during their greater length are characterized by flowing with rapid mountain current in a narrow timbered gorge of canyon-like formation. To losing their impetuous current, the valley widens. The current slackens to dead water. The stream becomes from 20 to 40 feet deep, with banks almost 6 feet above low water mark, but which unfortunately in high freshets are overflowed, and to which overflow we failed to give a just estimate during this season, and which will be referred to hereafter. While building the bridge over the Pound Lake, we observed that during the earlier part of the day, a slight current upstream was perceptible, sufficiently so to move the bridge timbers, while late in the day it moved in the opposite direction. This phenomenon is only to be seen during the freshet months and is accounted for by the fact that the outlet lake is so small and so obstructed by boulders and rocks that dam its waters as to render it incapable of discharging the volume of water as fast as the feeders supply it. Hence the lake, swelling, forces a certain volume of water back, giving the appearance of a receding current, this changing again as soon as the lake has discharged itself of the surplus. The valley of the St. Joseph's is a beautiful gem embedded in a noble range of mountains. Viewed from an elevation on a summer's day, the scenery and effect is grand and picturesque, the river winding from side to side in graceful curves, while copses of willow, cottonwood, and alder fringe its banks, and silvery lakes dot here and there the green sward in which it is clothed. The spurs that form its either boundary, gently rising to an elevation of 1,000 feet, are densely clad with one of the finest growths of fir and pine to be found in the mountains, and enlivened as it is with here a camp of hunters and there a light bark canoe of an Indian, forms one of the most beautiful scenes it was our fortune to meet with in the Rocky Mountains. It was in this valley that as early as 1842, the Jesuit fathers chose a site for the first of their Rocky Mountain missions, a small plateau projecting into the valley from the north, where fine springs gushed from the slopes on which the forest lay, as it yet untouched by the woodman, and a rich virgin soil smiled in a beauty of profusion, cultured by the hand of nature alone, offered them a choice garden that, with slight attention, should yield abundant fruits. Here they maintained themselves for many years until finding the overflow of the lower portion of the valley entered as an impediment both to pleasant travel and to the extension of their fields, they removed to their present location on the Coeur d'Alene Lake. The overflow of the Coeur d'Alene and St. Joseph Rivers and the means of preventing it is a subject to which I have given much attention, and having made surveys both in high and low water, I have been enabled to collect many facts and data, which I will treat of at greater length at a future point of my report. 4 miles up the valley, we selected a suitable place for crossing by a ferry boat. We immediately set the whip sawyers in the timber to get out the necessary lumber and some men to burning tar, and being provided with the necessary oakum, we built 2 flatboats, 42 feet long, 12 feet broad, and 2 feet deep, one for the St. Joseph's and the other for the Coeur d'Alene. The latter, when completed, was rowed down into the lake and thence up the Coeur d'Alene River to a point selected for its crossing. While this was being accomplished, the divide between the two streams was examined, the road marked out, and several parties placed at work upon it. The distance from the St. Joseph's to the Coeur d'Alene is 12 miles, passes through a partially timbered country, and gives a good location. Indications of gold were observed and much quartz scattered over the ground. Springs of water occur at convenient distances and small tracts of land capable of cultivation. Game consisting of bear and deer were occasionally found, and an abundance of mountain grouse. This work from the St. Joseph's crossing involved the building of a corduroy 400 feet long over a wet section of the river bottom and a heavy excavation up a suitable spur in order to gain the divide 700 feet above. This entire work occupied our force until the 5th day of August, 1859. During this interval, our topographers were engaged in tracing the St. Joseph's to its sources in the Bitterroot Mountains, marking its tributaries and defining its boundaries, also in making a survey of the Coeur d'Alene Lake. This last is a noble sheet of water, about 8 by 22 miles in extent, with a depth of from 50 to 55 feet, and bounded on all sides except at the points of juncture by its arms by high sloping timbered spurs. It is about 2,000 feet above the level of the sea and filled with an abundance of delicious salmon trout. The line to the Coeur d'Alene River being completed by the 5th of August, I moved the entire train to its left bank, where it remained in camp until the 9th, when the road for 9 miles up its left bank to the point of crossing was completed. This work consisted of a side cut of a fourth of a mile along a broken, rocky spur jutting upon the river's edge, building 3 bridges and cutting through a slight growth of timber near the point of crossing. Our boat being in readiness, we crossed the river on the 10th and remained on the left bank until the morning of the 16th, engaged with our entire force in opening the line thence to the Coeur d'Alene mission, which involved building 3 bridges, making a cut of 1 mile of excavation along difficult spurs, and cutting through timber for 3 miles, which when completed gave us an excellent road. On the morning of the 16th of August, we reached the mission 200 miles from Walla Walla. This was one of our fixed points from which began our mountain work proper. That this proved a difficult task to handle, our 3 years' labor abundantly proves. I would here state that the same features mark the valleys of the St. Joseph's as characterized that of the Coeur d'Alene: fine tracts of land for settlement, abundance of timber, and most excellent grazing, with mill sites on many of the smaller tributaries. Reaching the mission, we determined to make it a depot point for our train until such time as our work in advance should enable us to move forward. Placing the depot under the charge of Lieutenant White, we divided our force into several sections and distributed them along the line of work for 10 miles. This work consisted of timber cutting and clearing, building small bridges, corduroying wherever the ground was wet and marshy, and making side cuts wherever it was sidling or where the formation of the spurs compelled it. Crossing the Coeur d'Alene a mile above the mission, we lose sight of the river till reaching the 4 mile prairie, a point 4 miles beyond, and again lose sight of it until reaching a point we call the 10 mile prairie. This section of the road for the first 4 miles passes mostly through a timbered region and along the south foot of the spurs, making back from the river till it reaches the 4 mile prairie, after which it again enters a timbered region till reaching 7 mile prairie, and then again through timber until it reaches 10 mile prairie. Each of these prairies afford good campgrounds, and the first was formerly cultivated by the fathers. This soil is good. It contains about 100 acres. 7 Mile Prairie is an excellent camping ground, but not so well suited for cultivation. It is abundantly fed by springs and creeks and contains about 4 square miles. Traces of gold are said to have been found here. 10 Mile Prairie has many springs and is very wet in the early part of the year. It contains about 1 square mile and is bounded on one side by timbered spurs and on the other by the banks of the Coeur d'Alene. Fringed at this point with pine and cottonwood, it produces a rich growth of meadow grass, and its soil in places is alkaline. It might be reclaimed by ditching and would then be a fertile and desirable spot. We chose this as our second depot, as it afforded us a good grazing range for our stock, and from it we also cut a quantity of hay. The work from the mission to the 10 Mile Prairie occupied us until the 17th of August, when we again brought forward our entire train to the new depot. Everyone was moved except the astronomical party under Mr. Wiesner and Mr. Kolecki. We were left at the mission during a lunation to fix the position of that point. Our position at Walla Walla had already been determined by a 6-week series of observation, and our plan was to occupy as many fixed points as time and circumstances would allow. While the Coeur d'Alene mission, we had sent out 2 parties to explore and bring back such data as would guide our judgment in our further movements. The one assigned to Mr. P.M. Engel, whose duties were to cross the bed of mountains along the south fork of the Coeur d'Alene River and strike the Clark's Fork at or near Thompson's Prairie in order to see if the country along this route was adapted to a cheap location. In this undertaking, he was provided with the necessary Indian guides and outfits and directed to pursue his examinations up the Clark's Fork to the Pend'Oreille Mission and return via the route of the Bitterroot, recrossing the mountains via Sohan's Pass and thence to our camp. This was fully and satisfactorily accomplished and developed the fact that the features of the mountains precluded the possibility of securing a line in that direction. The second party was placed in charge of Mr. Sohan with directions to pass rapidly forward and mark in a general manner the location to ascertain the best point of passage over the Coeur d'Alene Mountains and to continue his examination down the valley of the St. Regis Borgia to the Bitterroot and thence up to the Hell's Gate Valley. For this purpose, he too was provided with the best Indian guides he could procure and fulfilled his mission satisfactorily, returning to camp by the 15th of September. From my own knowledge of the country and the additional data brought in by Mr. Sohan, I saw that we had to content ourselves with the cheapest location that the peculiar features of the valleys of the Coeur d'Alene and St. Regis Borgia warranted. Both of these valleys were densely timbered, with here and there a prairie affording scanty grass. Both of the valleys at points verged toward canyons, and the rivers were serpentine in their course, leaving alternate flats and spurs along their banks. Hence, the character of the streams necessitated frequent crossings or long and difficult side cuts to avoid them. The latter was a work of great magnitude and incompatible with the means at our disposal. Hence, the former was our only alternative. Our work, consequently, from the 16th of August to the 4th of December, 1859, consisted in cutting through this densely timbered section of 100 miles, building small bridges where required, and grading in thousands of places made necessary by the physical nature of the country. We likewise graded an ascent of 1 3/4 miles to the summit of the Coeur d'Alene Mountains. This work was heavy, and in so brief a report as herewith given justice cannot be done to the industry and fortitude of the men while mastering this wilderness section. The standing timber was dense, and the fallen timber that had accumulated for ages formed an intricate jungle well calculated to impress one with the character of impracticability. Suffice it to say that we mastered the many difficulties with which its construction was fraught and reached our winter camp in the St. Regis Borgia Valley on the 4th of December. As we had been obliged to keep our stock in the mountains until they were covered with snow, many had died from starvation and exposure. I had at first intended to reach the Bitterroot River, but winter overtaking me, I did the best in my power and made a point on the St. Regis Borgia below the last crossing. It was to attain this that I pushed my stock to the last point of endurance, dreading to be caught in a mountain gorge to battle out the winter, or to contend with the high water of the coming spring. As stated previously, we did not reach our winter camp until the 4th of December, and already had our men worked in the snow at great discomfort, though with cheerfulness and zeal. Becoming settled in our camp, we forwarded our stock to the Bitterroot Valley, but the distance was 100 miles, the ground covered with snow, and the mountain trails difficult and slippery. These, together with their enfeebled condition, caused the loss of a greater number of them before they reached the valley. But there was no point for pasturing short of this, and they must either reach it or perish in the snow. I took the precaution to have the beef cattle driven to camp and slaughtered, and the beef frozen, in which condition it kept until the month of March. The truth was that the amount of work required was immense, and very much underestimated both by myself and others, for we only truly appreciated it when we came to handle it in detail. It was completed, however, by our party with an industry and interest seldom evinced on similar occasions. We occupied the summit of Sohan's Pass for a period of 6 weeks with our transit and determined to position with great accuracy. From this point, it was sent to the crossing of the Bitterroot River, which we occupied from November until April, and here obtained a very important fixed point. Early in November, I sent Mr. Engel forward to the Bitterroot Valley, there to organize a small party and proceed to Fort Benton, mark the general features of the line, and bring me back such data as would control my judgment in future movements. Our men were set to work erecting such log huts as our wants demanded, and to the camp I gave the name of Cantonment Jordan. It was situated in a dense bed of timber that furnished both building material and fuel, had many fine springs, and was securely sheltered from the winds by friendly rims of mountains. We erected an office and occupied the entire winter in compiling field notes, completing maps as far as our materials sufficed, and writing such memoirs and reports as would furnish the Bureau with exact information on all points connected with our operations. The office hours of employees were from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. and from 6 till 9 p.m. The men were employed in gathering and preparing fuel and the ordinary labors incident to camp life. Guard duty was kept up merely to preserve discipline, as the snow was an effectual barrier against Indian depredation or Indian surprise. The question of snow had been with me an all-important one, and with the view of arming myself with facts as to its fall and depth, I had snow gauges prepared along the route, either by cutting off the tops of trees or planting posts graduated to a scale of feet and inches, so that when the mailmen passed, which they did every month, they might accurately note its depth. I have had this done during 2 winters and am enabled to state definitely the depth attained during any month at every point of the route. These show that in the upper Coeur d'Alene and St. Regis Borgia valleys it fell to the depth of from 2.5 to 3 feet, in the higher portions to from 3 to 5 feet, and on the summit of the mountains from 7 to 9 feet. This is an objection to this route of so vital importance when compared with that via Clark's work, that, as I before stated, had I known in 1854 what I did not learn till 1859, I should by all means have recommended the latter. At least as far as regards the portion lying between Antoine Plants and Hell's Gate, During the winter of 1859, Spokane Gary brought the mail by the way of Clark's Fork, and though he lost one horse en route, yet he nevertheless made the trips mostly on horseback. As soon as this fact was brought to my notice, I sent an inquiry on foot and found this fact to hold, that no Indians had ever been known to cross the mountains in winter via the Coeur d'Alene route, while it was quite an unusual thing for them to do so via the Clark's Fork. Further investigations of this point have proved of marked value and must enter as essential elements into the location of any railroad line that would seek the Columbia via its upper tributaries. We find this meteorological fact to exist, that if we take the isogeminal line which crosses the country in the latitude of St. Joseph's, Missouri, and trace this line westwardly, we reach Fort Laramie. When varying from the line of latitude, it trends northwestwardly and passes between the Wind River Mountains and the Black Hills of Dakota, reaching the headwaters of the Yellowstone at the hot spring and geysers of that stream, thence again to the Beaverhead Valley, crossing the main range of the Rocky Mountains at the Deer Lodge Valley in latitude 47 degrees north. In other words, in the longitudinal from St. Joseph's to the Rocky Mountains, it has gained 6 degrees of latitude, which remarkable increment continues as we trace it further westward, for the line crossing the range grasps the valley of the Hell's Gate and keeps it till it reaches the Bitterroot, and thence, trending northwestward, strikes the Clark's Fork at the Ponderay Lake. From this point, it trends south and comes down to the Walla Walla in Washington Territory. Thus, we find the same climate along the Clark's Fork, Hell's Gate, Upper Missouri, and Yellowstone Rivers that we find at St. Joseph's, Missouri. This is as true as it is strange, and shows unerringly that there exists in this zone an atmospheric river of heat flowing through this region, varying in width from 1 to 100 miles, according to the physical face of the country. This affects the kingdoms of natural history, botany, and climatology to such an extent that herein we find mild winters, vigorous grasses even in midwinter that enable stock to be grazed on the open hills, and gives a facility of travel during the severest seasons of the year. There is no doubt in my mind that this fact will yet be turned to a practical utility to the extent of opening this route by a wagon road when the mail coach and the immigrant wagon can, each and every month, make the trip overland from the Missouri to the Columbia. This line, once opened, would prove the great pioneer to the railroad which is destined to tap the interior of the northern mining section of the Rocky Mountain system, and which will have its outlet to the North Pacific either via the mouth of the Columbia or Puget Sound. The effect of this important fact had a material bearing upon the time of our resuming work in the spring of 1860. The point chosen for our winter camp was 15 miles from the Bitterroot Ferry through a densely timbered section involving heavy labor. The winter at the main camp proved severe, while at the ferry it was generally mild and pleasant, with less snow by 1.5 feet, and although only 15 miles distant, like a new climate. In fact, to compare the climates of these two points was like the difference of spring and winter, for one was situated within this river of heat and the other without it. So apparent was this difference in the month of February that I could resume work with advantage along the Bitterroot River, whereas the snow and frozen condition of the section from my camp to the ferry rendered it impossible to work this till late in the spring. I determined at once to throw forward all my men upon the Bitterroot, there build boats for the transportation of our supplies up the river, and resume work. We could not use our animals, as their condition and the want of grass would not allow of their being brought down to us at so early a date. To carry our supplies this distance of 15 miles by hand involved much labor. The men transported on their backs 2 months' supplies, all their tents and personal baggage, and setting to work at the crossing, got out the necessary lumber for 6 bateaux and a large flat, the last to be permanently left at the crossing, and the former to be used in transporting our supplies and baggage up the river as our work progressed. The location for 30 miles, lying immediately along the bank, right bank, gave us every facility in moving camp. The different sub-parties were arranged with a view to efficiency, each under the supervision of a chief to whom, as I was about to leave the party for a period to visit the Indians to the east and prepare for my spring and summer movements, I gave certain instructions which are herewith appended and which set forth the nature of the work. I then placed the whole command under charge of Lieutenant J. L. White. During the winter months, my mind was much exercised in regard to the time when I should reach the Missouri and whether the summer of 1860 would not prove a proper time for carrying out the project originally set on foot by Jefferson Davis and promised to be carried out during Mr. Buchanan's administration, namely, a military movement via these two rivers, Columbia and Missouri, and the route we were then opening. The success of such a movement would prove conclusively that a result had been obtained. I felt sanguine that we should reach the Missouri by the early summer. The success of the steamers in reaching Fort Benton in 1858 and 1859 was one point accomplished. Looking upon the necessity of the companies then serving in East Oregon and Washington being replenished in numbers by the coming summer, and the fact of my reaching Benton in the spring with a large and empty wagon train, which could be judiciously and advantageously used in connection with such a movement, I thought the spring of 1860 was, above all other periods, the proper time for testing the merits of our road. With this object in view, I dispatched to Washington Mr. W. W. Johnson, a young man then in my employ, whose thorough knowledge of the work pointed him out as a suitable person to perform what I desired. He left my camp for Washington City with letters for the Secretary of War, Topographical Bureau, General Jessup, and Governor Stevens, setting forth my views in full detail and pledging my energy and determination that nothing should be left undone to secure the full success of the movement recommended. This was to send 300 recruits from St. Louis to Fort Benton in the spring by the steamers of P. Chateau and Company with 4 months' supplies, and that I would meet them at Fort Benton with my train, with which they could make the trip to Walla Walla in 60 days. It is needless to narrate all the details that followed my recommendation, nor the various difficulties that beset our pathway to the right and left on the part of callous and apathetic persons, nor those that had to be handled from the inception of the enterprise to its final completion. Suffice it to say, the movement was ordered, its details and management were judicious, and 300 recruits shipped direct from St. Louis supplied the vacancies in companies then stationed in East Oregon and Washington at an estimated savings of $30,000 to the government. This movement had the effect of keeping in subjection the turbulent disposition of the Indians, transforming while en route recruits into soldiers, affording protection to the immigrant, security to the pioneer settler and tiller of the soil, and giving a practical test of the value of a route which, from the days of Jefferson, who initiated the project of opening a North Pacific communication, to the present date of its practical accomplishment, has had zealous friends and advocates. Having perfected all the details for resuming work in the spring of 1860 and seeing the parties duly engaged, I proceeded to the Bitterroot Valley and held a talk with the Indians whose dispositions towards myself had always been friendly. The necessity of getting my supplies from Fort Benton and the condition of my own animals compelled me to lay my wants before the Flatheads. I told them I needed 117 horses with pack saddles and from 15 to 20 of their men to accompany Mr. Sohan across the mountains. They promised me a reply the next day when they would send me as many sticks as they had men and horses to furnish. The next morning, their chief Ambrose came to Fort Owen, where I was a guest, with a bundle of 137 sticks, each representing a horse or a man. Such nobleness of character as is found among some of the Flatheads is seldom seen among Indians. And I here record to their credit that I never had a want but which, when made known to them, they supplied, and that they always treated myself and my parties with a frank generosity and a continuous friendship. They were paid for the use of their animals and the services of their men and made the trip in the month of March safely across the Rocky Mountains, bringing me back 11,000 rations. I also dispatched from this place an express to Salt Lake, making a requisition upon Colonel Crossman for 50 mules. My express man, Ned Williamson, was caught in the mountains by deep snows near the head of the Snake River, lost his horses, made snowshoes from his saddle rigging, and though snowblind for several days, made the greater portion of the 500 miles on foot, reaching Camp Floyd safely, and returned on horseback with a single companion, making the whole trip to and from within the period of 50 days. He proved himself a hearty fellow and showed what a man can accomplish when the will is strong. In company with Lieutenant Lyon, I then visited the Pendre Mission to procure fresh vegetables for my men who already were affected with symptoms of scurvy. We had at this time about 25 cases of this disease, all of which readily yielded under the care of my brother, Dr. James A. Mullen, to the specifics of fresh vegetables and vinegar.